So this is the translation and the purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. King Parikshit thought, due to my neglecting the injunctions of the Supreme Lord, I must certainly expect some calamity. I must certainly expect some difficulty to overcome me in the near future. I now desire without reservation that the calamity come now, for in this way I may be freed for the sinful reaction and not commit such an offense again. The Supreme Lord enjoins, the Supreme Lord enjoins that brahmanas and cows must be given all protection. The Lord is himself very much inclined to do good to brahmanas and cows. Gaur Brahmanai Hityaja. Maharaj Parikshit knew all of this, and thus he concluded that his insulting a powerful brahmana was certainly to be punished by the laws of the Lord. And he was expecting something very difficult in the very near future. He therefore desired the imminent calamity to fall upon him and not his family members. A man's personal misconduct affects all his family members. Therefore, Maharaj Parikshit desired the calamity to fall on him alone. By suffering personally, he would be restrained from future sins, and at the same time, the sin which he had committed would be counteracted, so that his descendants would not suffer. That is the way a responsible devotee thinks. The family members of a devotee also share the effects of a devotee's service unto the Lord. Maharaj Prahlad saved his demon father by his personal devotional service. A devotee son in the family is the greatest boon or blessing of the Lord. Om Gyanatimarandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuram Minitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadadi Swapadantitam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamsha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitantam Sajidam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devan Shri Radha Krishna Pada Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamsha Hey Krishna Karna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastate Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vishabham Musate Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Panchakalpa Turubhascha Kripa Sindhu Vevacha Patita Nam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Maha Amo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Staya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Namine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pujarine Nivishesha Shunyavadi Pashtasaje Sadarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Padadhar Shivasadi Gauravaktivinda. From the heart, everyone. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Okay, so I'll just quickly share my screen. Okay, so I just want to check some given through that I'm showing the correct screen and not my actual PowerPoint where I've got my notes on.
Yeah, what you need to do is to go into display settings. Okay, if you share your screen again, can you hear me?
I think I've got it now. Is that better?
That's much better. Thank you so much.
Okay, so I wanted to give some context on this verse, as you can see from this picture here. So what's happened, this chapter is entitled The Appearance of Sukadeva Goswami. So Parikshit Maharaj, who is the emperor of the earth at that time, he's been traveling all over his kingdom and he has become overcome by thirst and hunger. And he finds an ashram upon where Shamatha Rishi is in deep meditation. When he enters, because of the mystic trance that Shamatha Rishi in, he doesn't notice the presence of the king. And feeling dejected and rejected, Parikshit Maharaj feels that he has been disrespected because he's from the Kshatriya order and the Brahmana hasn't respected him and therefore not welcomed him very nicely. So because of his cold reception, he decides to put a dead snake around the sage's head. Upon leaving the ashram and on his journey back home, he realizes that he's made a grave mistake. Upon his own reflection, Supersoul within his heart has given him the indication and reflection that that actually wasn't the correct thing to do. And originally he had thought that Shamika Rishi was just pretending to be in trance so that he didn't have to receive him. And then he started to think, okay, maybe there is a, he probably was in mystic trance and didn't notice me being there. So he immediately thinks and he realizes that he made a grave mistake. He's fully aware of the laws of God, and he comes from a family of saintly kings. You know, he's, the Pandavas are his grandparents. Kripacharya is his spiritual master, and he's a fully trained Kshatriya in Dharma as well, and he's also subservient to the Lord. So he actually understood there himself, without anybody telling him, that he had neglected the duty of protecting the Brahmanas. And instead of protecting them, he had insulted them. And he understood the fact that every action was due to come to him. So yesterday, Ram Lakshman Prabhu spoke a lot about repentance, so I won't speak much on that today. But what is important is for us to understand that being human, that we make mistakes, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we should then defend our wrongdoing and try to guard against it. So we see in the mood of Parikshit Maharaj, he's repentant. He realizes and immediately admits his fault. He doesn't turn around and say, well, it was Shamika's fault. Shamika should have realized that I was present. He should have realized me being there. He actually realizes himself that I was at fault. And then he immediately begins to repent his actions. He's thinking, oh, what have I done? You know, the laws of God are there, and I respect the laws of God, and I follow the laws of God. Why have I done this? And this mood shows that he had, and from the verse we can understand that, you know, he's asking calamity to come to him. He asks, in fact, he desires for it to come to him straight away. So this shows that his willingness to accept punishment for his actions that he's done. And also, finally, he was ready to take action and accept, you know, if he had to do something to make up for what he did incorrectly, he was ready to do that also. So what's interesting is that he doesn't actually make any excuses for himself, like, you know, claiming I'm the emperor of the world, I have a right to be annoyed, you know, I should be respected by all. He actually didn't have any pride of his position. He didn't have any pride of his position. He didn't have any pride for his wealth, his fame, his magnanimous family that he was from. And this shows us how hard it was for Kali to infiltrate or influence in the presence of Parikshit Maharaj, as we can see in the verse, in this following verse, which is from Bhagavatam, also Canto 1. So Canto 1, verse 17:24, Parikshit Maharaj says to Kali, he says, Tapa socham deya satyam iti pada kriti kritaha adharma shaystaryo bhaganat smaya sangha madai sava. He says, in this age of satya, truthfulness, your four legs were established by the four principles of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. But it appears that your three legs are broken due to rampant irreligion in the form of pride, lust for women, and intoxication. So here we can understand from this verse that actually false pride is described as irreligion. It is actually one of the things that damages the pillars of Dharma. And therefore, it gives the opportunity for Kali to have more power. So it's really important for us to recognize when we find ourselves being influenced by the sense of pride or an inability to accept fault for our mistakes, or in fact, trying to blame others for something that we are actually at fault of, because it means that we are actually helping Kali in his influence through false pride. So there's times of reflection that is required when mistakes are made. Instead of immediately reacting, to try and think on reflect, and rather than immediately blaming the other person or thinking, does this person know who I am? How dare I be treated in such a way? To actually sit and reflect and think, you know, actually, I'm nobody. I'm actually just a servant of the Supreme Lord, and I shouldn't be expecting all of this kind of respect from others. So the moment we identify with our body and our mind and all the possessions that we have that are related to the body, whether it be beauty, fame, family wealth, our schooling or our academic qualification, it may be a position in the workplace which we are identifying with. This is actually all the false ego and not the true ego. And this allows Gully to influence us and those around us. So Maharaj Bruksha is actually a wonderful example of a Raja Rishi. So Raja meaning king and Rishi meaning saint. So he's a saintly king. He doesn't identify with anything related to his body, and he immediately takes responsibility for his wrongful desire and actions. And he desires that, please can calamity come my way. And as a community of devotees, we're always conscious and we endeavor to follow the four relative principles in our lives. Why? Because Srila Prabhupada explains to us that by following the four regulative principles, we can in fact differentiate ourselves from animals who do the same things as like sleeping, eating, defending and mating. And to understand that actually being prideful chips away at our ability to be merciful to others. It may make us feel that we are better than another living entity. We may be prideful of our human body, of our female body, of our male body, of our position that we may have. So it chips away at that merciful kind of propensity that we have. So there's four pillars of Dharma, as we're all aware, which are the four regulative principles. I'm sure we're all familiar with them. So Dharma is actually upheld by these four regulative principles. And I'm sure you all heard earlier on in Canto 1, in the earlier chapters, that Bruksha Maharaj comes upon a cow and a bull whose legs are being hit by Gully, who's actually a Shudra, but is in the dress of a king, and he's actually breaking the legs. So can you imagine this structure? If this structure, even if one of the pillars were taken out, it would actually, Dharma, which is being held, it would actually crumble or fall apart. So that's why it's important that we, you know, like most religions, they have certain pillars, and within Sanatana Dharma, we have these pillars of Dharma within Krishna consciousness. So the first one is no meat eating. By not meat eating or by not causing harm to other living entities, we uphold the pillar of mercy. By not gambling, it upholds the pillar of truthfulness. It takes away that desire to kind of cheat or to try and gain something in a way without having to endeavor too much. To not have any illicit relations actually upholds the pillar of cleanliness in terms of body, mind and words. And no intoxication upholds the pillar of austerity. Rather than drowning ourselves with austerities or drowning ourselves in intoxicants, we deal with the mind, we deal with the issues that are there at hand. So pride can actually chip away at any one of these. And the principles of religion are not actually any dogmas or man-made formulas. They're actually there. They're observances, such as austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. So Prabhupada explains, actually, that the mass of people should actually be taught to practice these principles from childhood. And austerity means to accept voluntary things, which may not necessarily be very comfortable for the body, but are conducive for spiritual realization, such as fasting. Okay, in the same way, cleanliness is important in order for, you know, the body and mind, and to not identify too much with the body and mind as well. Okay, so now, as humans, we're all subject to four defects, which many of you have heard before as well. So from Sri Upanishad, we hear that our senses are imperfect, that because our senses are imperfect, we are subject to illusion. And because we're subject to illusion, we make mistakes. And therefore, when we make mistakes, we have a propensity to cheat, to not admit our mistakes. We cheat others and others may cheat us. So if we continue on this point of truthfulness and pride, it's so important that we are honest in our dealings as humans. Because we're subject to the four defects, we should understand that there's no pride in being human. There's no pride in, shifting away from the blame, to understand, yes, we're humans, we make mistakes, and to accept the fact that when we do make a mistake, that mistakes can happen. We're not invincible. We're not God. But to be honest in our mistakes and be humble in being able to admit them in certain circumstances. Okay, so in some way or another, we can say that we have some control over how much Galit actually influences our lives by following the four regulative principles that are set out for us and trying not to be prideful or not to have false ego. So we can see the example of the emperor of the world. He had such great principles and set such a good example to all the citizens of the world. So we hear in the purport, actually, and the verse, that Bharikshit realized that he had disobeyed the orders of the Lord. He had done something against the injunctions of the Supreme Lord. And what does that mean? What does it mean that he went against the injunctions of the Lord? So it's described that austerity is in the mode of goodness. You probably come across it in the Bhagavad Gita before. And the mode of goodness explains that one should be respectful to the Lord and to his representatives. We should be respectful to the brahmanas, the gurus, our superiors, the elders, the Vaishnavas. And even Arjun states in the Bhagavad Gita in verse 2.4 that, O killer of enemies, O killer of Madhu, how can I counteract with the arrows in battle like Bhishma and Drona, who are worthy of my worship? So Arjun knew, okay, maybe I shouldn't go to battle with these great personalities because they are my seniors and I have a lot of regard for them. So Bharikshit realized that he had caused an offense to Shamukha Rishi, actually, who was worthy of his respect. And Super Soul in his heart had guided him to realize he had done something wrong. And as a Kshatriya, it was his duty to protect the Brahmanas and not to actually cause them harm or to insult them. And he was feeling repentant. Okay. So I just wanted to quickly cover the interdependence of the Varnas and how important Varnashram Dharam here is. So we can start from anywhere, but I will start off with Kshatriyas because we're talking about from the perspective of Bharikshit Maharaj. So we're actually really fortunate that in so many different ways, Krishna displayed his protective energy, through different ways, which we learn in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And actually the Varnashram system itself is an interdependent system. So that all areas are protected and taken care of by persons within Varnashram being dependent on each other. And there's a system of mutual protection, of shelter and dependency. And the same will go for ashrams too. So just quickly run through this. So how are we interdependent on each other? And why is it that Bharikshit Maharaj realized that he's done something wrong? So as Kshatriyas, it is their duty to protect the Brahmanas at all times. And the Brahmanas are protected of the Kshatriyas in the sense that they offer they're in the mood of advising the king. They're in terms of how to run the kingdom correctly according to the laws of God. The Brahmanas are there with blessings and knowledge for the Kshatriyas so that they could live their lives in a saintly way. And we know from all the different epics that are there and the Srimad Bhagavatam that the kings were actually saintly. They were like rishis. They were sages that fully knew Vedic culture and Vedic knowledge. And therefore they were able to rule the kingdom very happily and people prospered and lived happily. So the Brahmanas in turn served the Kshatriyas. The Kshatriyas serve the Vaishyas and the Shudras. The Kshatriyas serve the Vaishyas by offering them protection also, and protection to the Shudras. And the Kshatriyas provide everything that the Shudras need in terms of clothing, shelter, donations, anything that is required in order for them to be comfortable. And then the Vaishyas in turn serve the Kshatriyas by providing agriculture, food products in the form of taxes. The Vaishyas also serve the Shudras by giving them an opportunity to engage in employment. And then you have the Shudras, which work for the Vaishyas very nicely, helping them in their own ashram. And then you see the Brahmanas, they also protect the Vaishyas and they give them the knowledge, the Vedic knowledge that is required, and perform the sacrifices for them. And the Vaishyas in turn serve the Brahmanas and the Kshatriyas by providing all the the items that I needed for yokkies from cows and from agriculture in terms of grains, the ghee and everything that is required there. So it's actually an interdependent system. So with this system of interdependence, there isn't a sense of inferiority complex that one part of the system of Varna is higher than the other. In fact, it very nicely sits in a system whereby everybody is serving each other and therefore everyone is happy and satisfied. And now what we see in the material world today, because it's a breakdown of Varna or the misunderstanding of where Varna comes from, people think that Varna comes from, you know, birth. So if you're born as a, if you're born to a Brahmana father or Brahmana mother, they automatically become a Brahmana. But as per Vedic injunction, that's not correct. You do not automatically become a Brahmana by being born in a Brahmana family. You have to have the qualification. You have to have the correct training. In the same way, the example is given many times that just because your parent is a doctor, it doesn't mean the child is automatically a doctor. They have to qualify for that position. So this is a system of Varnas. And the same goes for ashram too. So the householders take care and support the children, the elderly, the brahmacharis, vanaprasthas, and sannyasis in terms of financially and in terms of providing care. And the brahmacharis and sannyasis, they serve society through knowledge and guidance. And the vanaprasthas provide advisory and wisdom and skills to the grahasthas and to the brahmacharis. So being dependent on one another actually creates a very rewarding and fulfilling world where everyone together can live in peace and harmony and work nicely in their devotional lives. You know, sometimes the concept of being dependent may one think that it puts you in a feeble position or in a kind of less able position, but it's not. It actually brings about great joy and everything works very nicely. So if we have a look at the next slide, so Bhriksha Maharaj says in the verse, he says, due to my neglecting the injunctions of the Supreme Lord, I must certainly expect some difficulty to overcome me in the near future. I now desire without reservation that calamity come now, for in this way I may be freed of sinful action and not commit such an offense again. So he's saying here, you know, let this calamity come upon me. I have broken the Vedic injunction, my duty to protect the Brahmanas. I've swayed away from that. And why does he take immediate ownership? He understands that if I am freed from this sinful reaction, that upon receiving his punishment, it will neutralize his sinful act. And by being punished, it's a genuine way of understanding and learning our lesson and making sure that we don't make the same mistake again. So both Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita explain that actually when one is suffering, one is reducing their pool of sinful acts. It may not feel like it at the time. We may feel a lot of pain. We may feel a lot of remorse. We may feel like blaming a lot of individuals. But actually, suffering makes us realize that we're actually producing the pool of our own sinful acts that we have committed before, whether it be in this life or a previous life. And in the same way, when we're enjoying material things, when we're happy and things are going great, we're actually exhausting the pool of our good deeds. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is a collection of wonderful pastimes where we can actually learn so much and take solace in our own lives of mistakes and reactions that we receive or actions that we make. And we can see that through the example of other great devotees who also have made mistakes to learn from them. So we can take the example of Daksha. So Daksha becomes very prideful of his position as Prajapati. He has pride over Lord Shiva. He feels that Lord Shiva is my son-in-law. And he takes this opportunity at a grand yajna to offend him gravely. Somebody who should be respected and, given a lot of awe, he is disrespected. And we see that the reaction to that is that he is beheaded by Virabhadra. Now, although he may have passed away at that point, the understanding is later on when Daksha receives the head of a goat and is brought back to life, he actually prays to Lord Shiva and he thanks him. He's like, I thank you again and again for decapitating me and taking away my life. Because in this life, you have given me the reaction to the sin that I performed by insulting you, then it will allow that I won't actually perpetually be burning in hell for the sinful reactions that I have caused to you throughout my lifetime. So actually getting a sinful reaction or undergoing some suffering makes us understand that, okay, we're getting what was due to us in this lifetime, and therefore we may not have to go into a lower birth or a less conducive birth or go to hell to suffer for our bad reactions, for our mistakes that we've made. So that's why the example of Daksha here is given, that actually it's good to be repentant and it's good to want to receive the calamity for any mistake we've made. The other example, also from the Bhagavatam, is Queen Suruchi and Dhruva Maharaj. Suruchi offends her little stepson, Dhruva Maharaj, at the age of 5. And Vedic injunctions state that being in the role of the mother, that she is there to give him love and nourishment and protection. But instead, due to her envy, she mistreats him. And the calamity that comes upon her is that she's burned up in a forest fire in the prime of her life. Another example is Brihaspati and Indra. Indra offends his guru Brihaspati due to his arrogance. And because he's disrespectful, he actually loses all of his opulence and he's conquered by the demons. And the demigods they ensue with a great fight with the demons, and his throne eventually, Indra's throne eventually becomes occupied. So this is where the person has got the reaction directly for the mistake they've made. And then let's look at an example of repentance. So here we see Ambarish and Durvasa Muni. Durvasa Muni greatly offends Ambarish Maharaj, although Ambarish Maharaj doesn't accept the offense himself. But Lord Vishnu becomes very upset that Durvasa Muni has offended his devotee, and therefore he sends his Sudarshan Chakra after the Durvasa Muni. Durvasa Muni, recognizing his mistake, actually falls at the feet of Ambarish Maharaj and begs for his forgiveness and repents his action. So here we see that the Durvasa Muni is saved through the mercy of the devotees, through the compassion, and through that mood of repentance and being regretful of one's mistake and behavior. And Ambarish Maharaj requests Vishnu to call off the Sudarshan Chakra. Okay, so now we know that Ambarish Maharaj is stating here that Brahmanas are to be respected. And we can see Krishna's own example, that when Narad Muni visited his palace, he was respected greatly by Krishna. He was welcomed very nicely with sweet words, by the washing of his feet, by offering him a highly respected seat. And Krishna saw personally to the service of Narad Muni. So that's one thing that is spoken about in the purport, about how Brahmanas should be treated, and Krishna sets the example himself. And we also see the example of Krishna taking care of the cows. The purport mentions that Brahmanas should be protected and taken care of, and so should the cows be. So he personally takes care of the cows from dawn to dusk. And so Bhrigshat Maharaj understood that he was to be punished by the laws of God because he didn't do any of those things. And he requests actually that may imminent calamity fall upon him, and not to his family members. And Prabhupada explains in the purport that a man's personal misconduct affects all his family members. You know, you probably see like in the news and things when either a child or a partner or even a parent has committed a mistake, when there's a court case going on, the whole family are brought into disrepute, and you see the family members covering their faces with items so that they're not, you know, videoed in the news. So in the same way, a man's personal misconduct actually does affect all of his family members. So Bhrigshat Maharaj actually desired that this calamity please fall on him alone, and that so that he would personally not commit any sins in the future, and that any sin that he committed would be counteracted so that his descendants would not suffer. So in this way, he takes responsibility for what has happened. So what's what's interesting actually is that we see how the example is given. Here we hear if a calamity, if something is done wrong, then the family suffers alongside. So we hear from this within the Srimad Bhagavatam the example of when actually somebody does something very great, actually the family is also benefited as well. So there's two sides to the coin. It's not just when something negative happens. When a devotee or a child or a member of the family does something great, the entire family is glorified. So here's the pastime of Prahlad Maharaj and Nrisingadev. So Prahlad Maharaj wants his father to be saved from all of the kind of suffering of the kind of pain that was inflicted towards Prahlad Maharaj. So he's saying, so here in this pastime, we see how because the family suffered consequences of anything done wrongly in the previous examples, here we can see that in the purple, a devotee child in the family is seen as the greatest boon or blessing and receives the greatest boon or blessing of the Lord. And it has very positive consequences because not only is the child blessed, but the immediate family is blessed. So it's described that seven generations of the family are blessed. And actually the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, chapter 10, verse 18, explains that actually 21 families that we have had in our previous lives are also blessed with a special mercy. So not just the family in our current lives, also the families that we may have been connected in previous lives, they also benefit greatly from any good action that we perform, especially devotional service. And we can see that in Prahlad Maharaj's example. So we should as much as possible, if we want to be peaceful in our life, if we want to be happy, if we want to live a good devotional life, the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam kind of requests us to try and follow the injunctions of the Supreme Lord in a way where we're free from pride, we try to live in an honest way, and we try to avoid any offensive behavior and to learn from the lessons from the exalted and gentle devotees of the Srimad Bhagavatam. We must also try to be regretful in any mistakes that we've made and repentant also, and be grateful in the reduction of our pool of our sinful and pious acts, so that actually we can be free from our karma, whether it be good or bad, and go back home, back to Godhead, in the honourable way that Parikshit Maharaj did. So I'll just read the purport of that particular verse. So, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Prahlad, O most pure, O greatly saintly person, your father has been purified along with 21 forefathers in your family. Because you were born in this family, the entire dynasty has been purified." So I'll stop there in terms of the verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Also today is a very special occasion. There's actually many special occasions today. It's the appearance day of Srimati Sita Devi. It's also the appearance day of Srimati Janava Devi, the wife of Lord Nityananda. And it's the disappearance day of Srimati Pandit. So I'll say a little bit about these wonderful personalities. So here's our Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ji from Bhaktivedanta Manor, where you're all at, or if anyone's tuning in, these are from these deities are from the manor in Watford, UK. So Sita Devi, we understand her to be a manifestation of the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi Devi. She's the eternal consort of Lord Ramchandra. And she has many names which she's called by, with just a few of them being Sita Devi, Vedahi, Methali, Janaki. So now Sita Devi and Lord Ram are eternally together in the spiritual world. They have a eternal relationship of husband and wife. It's only in this material universe do they seem to meet each other and get together and marry and be united. So earthly pastimes are slightly different from the spiritual world. So we know that in the material world, Sita Devi stumbles upon Lord Ram and they have the Swayamvara ceremony and they get married. So how does Sita Devi appear on the earth? Although being eternally present in the spiritual world, she also descends whenever Lord Ram does. So Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that he descends whenever there is a rise in religion, and he comes to re-establish the principles of religion. So his eternal consort always descends with him, whether it be as Radharani, Sita Devi, in all his different avatars, she comes with him. She's in his internal potency. So Sita Devi is the daughter of the earth goddess here on earth, Bhumi Devi. And she's actually one of the central figures of the Ramayana. So Maharishi Valmiki, who actually writes the Ramayana, he explains that Ramayana is actually known as the noble story of Sita Devi, Sitaya Charitam Maha. Her glory is actually sung by one of the poet saints called Tyagaraj. And he sings, O daughter of Janaka, the blessed souls of refugees, O consort of Sri Raghuram, bedecked with shining gem ornaments, pray, protect me always. You are the wind that destroys the clouds of demons like hundreds of heads of Ravan. You are the indweller in the hearts of the devotees. Your feet shine with the luster of gems and set in the crown of Indra. So King Janak was the wise king of Janakpuri, and he was actually childless. He was also a Rajarishi, a saintly king, and lived like a sage. And he didn't actually have any children, so he went about to do a yajna. And he started off by tilling the land. Apologies that the picture isn't of great quality, it's the only one I could find. So Janak Maharaj, while he was ploughing a piece of land to prepare it for performing a yajna, he was using a plough, and he unearthed a golden casket in which he found a beautiful girl. And he was overjoyed. Now, a land which is actually ploughed by a yoke is actually called Sita. So therefore, because he stumbled upon Sita in this way, he named her Sita. So upon having Sita Devi, he found that his good luck and things in the kingdom appeared to go really well. And it was highly blessed. So therefore, he was very pleased to have this daughter, Sita Devi, and his wife also became pregnant and had another daughter called Urmila. So they brought Sita Devi up with great affection, and they gave him good education. And they were filled with noble qualities, good behavior, intelligence. And they were, you know, Sita Devi and Urmila were both ideal princesses. So one day, Varshram came to visit. Varshram is a Shaktivesh avatar of Lord Vishnu. He came to visit one day, and he left his bow in a doorway. And once finishing his meeting, he came out and he couldn't find his bow anywhere. And upon searching, he had noticed that Sita Devi was actually playing with this toy, like it was, you know, just like a doll. And it's described that this bow was actually very, very heavy to lift. In fact, Varshram was the only one that could lift it and use it. So he was, you know, really surprised to see that Sita Devi was just playing with it so easily. And he said to Janak that the daughter is no ordinary girl. And when you find her a husband, you must find one of who has equal qualities of her, equal qualities to her. And in fact, because she's the only one other than me that can lift this bow, also the person that she marries must be able to lift this bow in order to win her hand. So we know how the story goes. Lord Ram comes, many kings come to the Swayamvara ceremony, which is like a self-selecting ceremony where the bride can actually choose her life partner from a choice of kings that have been gathered by the father. And nobody else could lift the bow. So many of them would come and see the bow and not even attempt it. They'd just simply offer their obeisances to the bow and leave. So when Lord Ram arrives with Vishwamitra, he's able to very easily lift up the bow and break it. So that made him, that proved his qualification to be able to win Sita's hand in marriage. So, okay. So they get married, and we'd like to discuss some other qualities of Sita's moon. So Sita Devi, she always likes to think of Lord Ram within her heart. She doesn't like to be separated from him. And we know that here on earth, she does become separated from him when she's kidnapped, when her chaya, her shadow form, is kidnapped by Ravan. But in the spiritual world, she's constantly with Lord Ram. So when she is separated from Lord Ram here in the material world, she's constantly united with him by chanting his name, Ram, Ram, constantly. And she's constantly seeking to reunite with him. She's very committed to him, and she's in constant meditation on him. And he protects her and gives her the strength to resist Ravan's many advances and allurements. So although Ravan delivers so many offers and threats, Sita is actually fixed in her faith and conviction. And she has great strength, and she calls upon her powers, actually. Sita Devi is actually very, very powerful, and she never really uses her powers unless completely necessary. And she says to Ravan, when she is in the groves of his garden, she says that, I would burn you to ashes myself by the power of my asceticism and chastity, but I do not have my Lord's order. So she does not take the life of Ravan. She doesn't kill him herself, because she hasn't had permission of Ram to do so. So this is her mood of submission and love towards Lord Ram. So once Lord Ram and his soldiers kill Ravan and the rest of the demons in the kingdom, Ravan's wife also, you know, says to over Ravan's body, she says, "Oh, greatly fortunate one, you came under the influence of lusty desires, and then you could not understand the influence of Mother Sita. Now, because of her curse, you have been reduced to the state of having been killed by Lord Ramchandra." So that's from Bhagavad Gita, Canto 9, Chapter 10, Verse 27. Okay. So three qualities of Sri Sita Devi. She's very forgiving. So when when Ravan is killed, Hanuman comes to the Ashoka Grove, and he suggests to her that, would you like me to kill all these other Rakshasis that have tormented you for such a long period of time? And she says, in her noble character, she says that these gods were just carrying out the orders of Ravan, and that no one should blame them. No blame should be attached to them. Any suffering I went through was due to my own misdeeds, which is the universal law. And this is her humility speaking. We know that Sita Devi is not under the influence of universal law, because she's a supreme goddess. But to be relatable to the audience who are humans, she speaks in this way. So she explains that a righteous person does not consider the offenses of others. The vow of not returning evil for evil was actually one of her greatest conducts and ornaments of her great personality. She was also very compassionate, explaining that we should be compassionate towards any sinners, because there is actually no one out there which is free from committing any sin. Sita is actually very open-hearted. So as when her and Lord Ram were returning to Ayodhya, she suggests to the monkey warriors to bring their wives along with them. She says, I will be very pleased if we can return to Ayodhya with the company of the wives of the monkey chiefs also. So in this way, she's showing her appreciation for the hard work that the Varuna race have performed. And so therefore, Ram stops the chariot and allows all of the Varuna race to come on the chariot with them, with their wives. And then Sita's gratitude. So she has many qualities. I'm just covering a few of them today, due to lack of time. So Sita is also very grateful. At the time of coronation of Sita and Ram, of their coronation, she wanted to give Hanuman as a gift, as something which was a token of her appreciation for everything that he had done for her. So she unclasps the necklace that is given to her by Lord Ram and looks at Lord Ram for his permission before giving it to him. Understanding that that's what she wanted to do, Lord Ram allows her to give this this necklace, and happily he places it around his neck. And another thing from the coronation as well, when Sita Devi saw the colors being thrown upon them, when she saw the color red flying in the air, it reminded her and showed it upon her gratitude towards Jatayu, because that red color flying in the air reminded her of the time when Jatayu's wing was chopped by Ravan, and blood spewed from his wing all over. And seeing that flying color, she was feeling great remorse and great compassion and gratitude towards Jatayu for trying to make attempts to save her. So in glorification of Jatayu, we can say that he gave up his life in the service and the protection of Sita Devi. And despite being so old, he was very brave and he held on to his life and tried to kill Ravana and cause as much damage as possible. And then he held on to his life despite being, his limbs being removed and his wings being removed, until Lord Ram could come and he could relay the message of where Sita Devi was, and he took her away. So the Ramayana proves the greatness of Sita Devi in so many different situations. It talks about her valor. It talks about her selfless love towards Lord Ram and all of their followers, and how Sita always stood by her husband and supported her through her strength. We hear about her strength of when Ravan abducted her and her torment by the Rakshasas. So I'm just going to briefly, because it's Janavadevi's appearance day, I just quickly mention one or two things on Janavadevi. She's the wife of Lord Nityananda. She's known as Janava Mata or Janava Ishvari. In the Gaura Ganadesh Dipika, which is a book which explains many things about who certain personalities are in the spiritual world, we understand Janavadevi to be Ananga Manjari of Vrindavan, who's actually the younger sister of Radharani and the energy of Lord Sri Nityananda. So all the devotees who are followers of Janavadevi are actually within the list of Lord Nityananda's devotees also. She has the mood and embodiment of the Panchatattva. And the Bhakti Ratnakara explains that she actually became an acharya after the Panchatattva wrapped up their pastimes here on earth. And she had many followers, and she gave the precious jewel of devotion here on to all of her followers. And also, just to acknowledge Madhu Pandit, who is the whose disappearance day is today. So there's no mention of him actually in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, but he is spoken about in the Bhakti Ratnakara. And it's described that he was a disciple of Gadadhar Pandit. He was one of the most intimate devotees of Lord Chaitanya. He would read Bhagavatam daily, and he took care of the deity Gopinath, which was actually discovered by one Bhattacharya, and he gave the worship of this deity to Mother Pandit. And he arranged to have a temple built. And actually, the great Vajranapa, which is the great grandson of Krishna, he had originally installed this Gopinathji in Vrindavan, and this is the deity that Sri Mother Pandit took care of. So I'd like to thank you for your attention and for your time today. I'd like to open up the forum for any comments, any queries, or any corrections of anything that I said today. So over to you, Sanketan Priyapur. Something's come through the chat, so I'll wait for Sanketan Priyapur to ask any other questions that come up. There is, in the last leg of Dharma, if the last leg of Dharma is truthfulness represented by no gambling, why is it that gambling is prevalent in today's society with betting stores found on almost every high street? Where is the truthfulness that is found today? Okay, so my understanding of this is that it's the other way around, because the last leg of Dharma, the way it's described, the way I understand it and the way it's described by the previous acharyas, is that it's not that an entire leg is wiped out from, so during the four yogas, one quarter each, in each yoga, one quarter of the leg is taken down. So it's not that one leg topples over entirely. It's like one quarter of a certain amount of truthfulness, a quarter of an amount of mercy, and a quarter of an amount of austerity is reduced as each of the yogas go on. So truthfulness was there, is there. And even on this last leg, we understand that truthfulness is hobbling, because anytime somebody tells lies, or anytime somebody does gamble or is dishonest, it is actually attacking the leg of truthfulness. And even actually described that in a daily basis by the exchange of money, even we are kind of contributing to the leg of truthfulness being broken down. Because if we look at money, it's not backed by any gold standard of any sort. It's like the note says that I promise the bearer of this a certain amount of money, and that certain amount of money isn't really there anymore in the bank. So unfortunately, without realizing, we're all contributing to that. And this is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam as well. So if anybody else would like to add any points to that, that would be great if you have any other wider understanding of that. So there's another question. How do we develop the qualities of Sita Devi as women in our own lives? Could you explain further on what chastity is and faithfulness? Do women require the support of qualified men like Lord Ram to practice these qualities, or it doesn't matter? Okay. So actually, developing the quality of Sita Devi is something that everybody will want to do, whether you be male or whether you be female, because chastity is an important quality to have, especially in our devotional lives. It means that we're very dedicated to the path in our devotional lives. So being chaste and faithful is a wonderful quality for both men and women to have. And we know that from Bhagavatam, Yudhishthira Maharaj is actually described as one of the most chaste devotees, because he's completely dependent on Lord Krishna for everything. But in terms of marriage, if we're speaking for marriage, in order for someone to flourish with the qualities of Sita Devi, it also needs to be matched with the qualities of a partner who have the qualities of Lord Ram, because it is together through a partnership that they are able to come together and be successful in what they do. So Lord Ram was very protective, he was very caring, he was very respectful of Sita Devi's views and her thoughts. And Sita Devi was very in awe of him. She was very submissive to him. So there was a mood of interdependence between the two, which is very beautiful, which is how marriage, which is described in the Shastras, all the examples that we see, is the unity between husband and wife, matching natures and matching moods, and a system of cooperation and keeping the Lord at the center, allows one to, hopefully live more peacefully within the Grahastha Ashram. I mean, I'm no expert on marriage. I go through struggles myself. We work through it. We work hard with the blessings of the seniors, with the guidance of the Bhagavatam, and with our seniors to try and in the best way serve each other and try to develop great qualities in our devotional life to be good partners to each other as well. Why did Sita Maharani suffer so much? So in the pastimes of the earthly pastimes of the Lord, it always seems like either Lord Ram or Sita Devi may have suffered so much at the hands of other personalities. But we understand it all to be an act and to be Leela, because Lord Ram comes down in the mood of Mariyada Purushottam, showing the ideal human being. So no one can inflict any sort of suffering upon the Lord, because the Lord is not subject to the three modes of material nature, to the modes of material nature, or the three types of suffering. So externally, it may seem like they're suffering quite a lot, but within their heart, they're very peaceful and always very blissful, because they are Sachidananda Vigraha, the form of bliss, happiness, and eternality. If in every yoke, every leg is diminished by one quarter, how is it that in Kali Yuga it is said that only truthfulness is left? Okay, so this is a really great question, and this is a question that I asked some of my seniors as well when I was studying this particular chapter. I asked some very similar questions to what are coming up at the moment. And that's what was explained to me, that the previous acharyas explained that actually we do see mercy today as well. We see how many people are vegetarian, how many people are turning vegan, how many people are working hard for the protection of children, the elderly, women and other men who are in a vulnerable position. We see austerity. There's so many people who don't take what intoxicants. So you can actually physically see that these other legs are still standing, because the world isn't just standing on truthfulness. The other legs are also there. So my understanding is that the other legs are still there also. And we can just have a look in our devotee community, and you can see very clearly that the truthfulness is still there, mercy is there, austerity is there as well. Is there any further questions or comments or corrections for anything that may have said today?
Thank you, Vrindavani. Mataji, thank you for an amazing class.